Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we take, articles, research, expert insights, and we try to boil them down to the really important stuff.
Basically giving you a shortcut to, well, being properly informed on a topic.
Exactly. And today, we're diving into something that might just change how you think about a really common experience, something often labeled, maybe misunderstood.
It's a really fresh take. It moves past the usual labels, deficit disorder. It tries to shed light on unique strengths instead.
That's it. We're talking about ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, but with a completely different frame.
A radical reframe, you could say.
Yeah. Imagine this. What if those ADHD traits, what if they aren't flaws? What if they're inherited things that were actually, like, crucial for survival way back when?
That's the hunter in a farmer's world idea.
Precisely. And it offers, well, not just hope, but maybe new ways to think about how people can really thrive today.
It's a framework that resonates with a lot of experts, actually. Richard Silberstein, he's a cognitive neuroscience professor, he said it fits so many of the ADHD youngsters and adults he's worked with. Because, it doesn't assume something's broken.
Right.
And Margaret Dawson, over at the Center for Learning and Attention Disorders, she noted this. This twist, as she put it, helps us see the value, the sometimes quite special value, in people with ADHD.
It's fascinating stuff. Might spark a bit of an aha moment for you listening. Maybe you ask yourself or people you know.
Could do, yeah.
So let's get into this reframe.
Mm.
For ages, I think many people, maybe myself included sometimes, have wondered, like Michael Popkin said, how nature could have made such a mistake, right?
Wow.
Creating something that affects so many.
We've generally seen it as a dysfunction. Something's wrong, needs fixing.
But what if that's just off?
Yeah.
What if that whole starting point is wrong?
Well, the key insight, and Tom Hartman's book really digs into this, is that maybe these traits are simply a matter of having some of the right skills for the wrong time.
Right skills, wrong time. I like that.
Yeah. It suggests ADHD isn't like an on-off switch. It's a spectrum. And the things we see as disorderly, they could actually be strengths. Maybe strengths that just need, a different approach in our modern world, our farmer society.
That makes sense, especially historically. I mean, people have noticed attention issues since, 1905?
Yeah, it's been in the books for over a century. But before the 1970s, really, if kids or adults showed these traits,
they were just labeled bad. Or maybe brain damaged.
Pretty much. It was always seen as something negative that needed to be corrected or managed.
Okay, but then how does evolution fit in? You mentioned these traits might have been useful.
Exactly. Think about genetics. Sometimes a gene that seems like a disadvantage now actually gave a survival edge in a specific place or time.
Like sickle cell.
Right.
Protecting against malaria.
Precisely. Or Tay-Sachs offering some protection against TB in certain populations. Or even cystic fibrosis, maybe helping against diarrheal diseases thousands of years ago.
Huh.
So in the same way, these leftover hunter genes, maybe they seem like a mismatch today, but back then, they could have been vital. It wasn't a mistake in the code. It was a feature for that environment.
Wow. Okay. That's a huge shift. But if you always heard deficit, how do you start thinking vital? Let's break down these archetypes. What does a hunter actually look like in this model?
Well, think flexible, impulsive, quick decisions, bursts of energy rather than slow and steady. Definitely the hare, not the tortoise.
Okay, I can picture that.
And cognitively, they often think visually. Pictures, experiences, that clicks better than abstract ideas or long strings of words.
Ah, so that's why just telling someone a bunch of steps might not work.
Exactly. Following multi-step verbal directions can be really tough. One adult with ADHD said their understanding improved vastly by a picture. It let their brain just grasp the pattern directly.
That makes so much sense, like pattern recognition over sequence following.
And looking at the common challenges. Losing things, interrupting, talking maybe too much or impulsively. Yeah, or that feeling of underachieving even when you've done stuff. Chronic procrastination, starting loads of things.
But not finishing them, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a moral failing, it's just how the brain's working.
It seems like it. And the impatience, the low frustration tolerance, that's tied into needing stimulation.
And you mentioned a paradox, worrying but also taking risks.
Right. They might scan for problems constantly but also jump into high-risk situations. It sounds contradictory, but it's all linked to that underlying drive for a certain level of, well, intensity or input.
Okay, that's the hunter. But we live in a farmer's world. So what defines the farmer archetype? How are they different?
almost the opposite in many ways. Farmers aren't easily distracted. They are the tortoise, slow, steady, sustained effort.
Good at the long game.
Exactly. Long-range planning, patience for repetitive work. They often value cooperation, teamwork. Think about traditional farming societies like in Japan, where everything was meticulously planned and done together.
And you said pure farmers don't usually get diagnosed with things.
Well, their traits just tend to fit better with the structures of modern society, schools, offices, schedules. They're less likely to run into friction that leads to a psychological classification. They kind of blend in more easily.
Okay, this is fascinating. And you mentioned something earlier, extending Maslow's hierarchy, the need to feel aliveness.
Yes. This is a really core concept that comes out of the ADHD research, looking at the thalamus and the reticular activating system, the RAS, in the brain. It suggests there's this fundamental human drive, maybe even a basic need, just to feel that one is alive.
How does that connect to the brain parts, the thalamus?
Think of the thalamus like a control valve, yeah, or maybe a graphic equalizer on a stereo. It controls how much sensory information gets through to your conscious awareness.
Okay.
For some people, often our hunters, it's like the faucet is mostly closed, the world feels a bit muted, quiet, so they're constantly seeking stronger sensations, more input, to just feel properly alive.
Ah, so that's the distractibility, scanning for something interesting.
Could be. Scanning the environment for stimulation. And impulsivity. That's like the brain yelling, now, now, I need input, and now. This need for aliveness is really characteristic.
I'm picturing a kid in class,
yeah,
right? Teacher's talking, it's not getting through the closed faucet, the brain's bored stiff.
It's demanding sensation, yeah.
So pulling someone's hair or making a noise,
mm,
it's not necessarily being bad. It's trying to, what did the source say? Leap up through the surface.
Exactly. Make the world vivid again. It's neurological.
And that ties into risk-taking too. Explorers, entrepreneurs.
It could explain a lot of it. Those high-stakes activities. They flood the system with adrenaline and other neurochemicals that the thalamus and RAS are really sensitive to. It directly feeds that need for intense sensation. It makes them feel alive.
Okay, so if that's the hunter's natural state, needing that stimulation,
mm-hmm,
how do stimulant medications like Ritalin fit in? Are they just suppressing that?
Not exactly suppressing. It's more like they help open the faucet. They provide a steady level of the stimulation the brain is craving internally. So when that basic need for aliveness is met by the medication, the drive to seek external distraction or act impulsively just decreases. They can sit still, they can pay attention because the world doesn't feel so quiet anymore. The brain isn't screaming for input.
It's providing the stimulation rather than demanding the person find it themselves.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. This hunter-farmer model,
mm-hmm,
it really throws a cultural clash into sharp relief, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Thinking historically how farming societies often, well, displaced hunter-gatherer cultures.
Yes, and the source material uses a pretty stark term for this. It talks about a cultural mental illness called wetiko.
Wetiko, what's that?
It's an indigenous term referring to behavior that's essentially amoral, predatory, cannibalistic, in a metaphorical sense, consuming others or the world for one's own gain. The source suggests this mindset originated in Mesopotamia with the rise of agriculture.
Wow. Okay. And why did these wetiko farmers, as the source calls them,
wow,
why did they succeed in dominating?
The material points to four main reasons. First, food production. Farming was way more efficient, maybe 10 times more. That meant bigger populations, bigger armies, simple maths almost.
Brute force.
Second, diseases. Farmers lived close to animals, developed immunities. When they encountered hunter-gatherers, those groups had no immunity. So disease became an unintentional but devastating weapon.
That's grim. Biological advantage turned weapon.
Yeah. Third, stability. Farming meant settling down, which allowed for specialization, making better weapons, organizing armies, things nomadic hunters couldn't match easily.
Makes sense. And fourth,
religious justification. The source argues the wetiko culture developed belief systems that basically said it was okay, even ordained, to exploit other people in the land. It saw non-wetiko people almost like resources. This was different from hunter groups who might fight, but rarely aimed to completely wipe out another tribe.
And these factors, which let the farmers dominate, also created a world that just didn't value the hunter traits anymore. The spontaneity, the exploration.
Exactly. The structure they built favored predictability, conformity, long-term planning. Farmer traits.
And the source suggests this wetiko domination continues today.
In a way, yes. It points to how our culture often celebrates success gained through exploitation, that sort of dog-eat-dog mentality, and it connects this to the messages people with ADHD often get.
That disempowering message.
Yeah. The underlying message can be, you're sick, I'm not, let me fix you. There's an anecdote in the material about Joe Parsons, whose father literally told him his brain was damaged and he could never be really normal. The source calls that message Wetico. It's soul-destroying.
It really is. And it makes you think about the Pygmalion effect, right? How expectations shape reality. Tell a kid they have a deficit, a disorder.
It can crush their self-esteem. They might start living down to that label. It's like setting them up to fail, almost.
So given all that, the history, the labels, the mismatch, how can hunters thrive?
Yeah.
How do they make it work in this farmer world?
Well, a big piece is finding the right niche. Career paths where hunter traits are actually pluses.
Like what?
Think police officers, firefighters, ER doctors, surgeons maybe, private detectives, journalists, salespeople, entrepreneurs, roles that need quick thinking, adaptability, handling novelty or crises, even trial lawyers.
High energy, quick decisions.
Exactly. The source mentions Kemmons Wilson, who founded Holiday Inn. He had his bear skinners. He'd go shoot the bear, find the deal, get the financing, and the bear skinners, probably more farmer types, would handle the nitty-gritty details.
Ah, playing to strengths, like Tom Hartman's own career path, jumping between different things, journalism, business, radio.
Yeah, it shows how that need for novelty can fuel success if you find the right outlets.
Okay, so finding the right job is key. What about individual strategies for managing things like focus or organization?
Breaking things down is huge. Big tasks feel overwhelming, so break them into small, manageable chunks. Pigeonhole jobs, the source calls it, like the novelist who just aims for 5 pages a day, makes a mountain feel climbable.
Just 5 pages. Okay. What about training attention? Is that possible?
People often think hunters can't focus, but the material suggests they can train it. Things like transcendental meditation or Vipassana mindfulness meditation.
Meditation. Mm. For someone easily distracted, seems tough.
It is tough, especially at first, but it's like learning any skill, like riding a bike. You practice, you get better. It strengthens those focus muscles in the brain.
Interesting. And what about managing, well, the modern world?
Yeah.
Technology.
Yeah, that's critical. Our world is constant stimulation. Things like smartwatches might actually be better than phones sometimes because they give specific notifications, not endless scrolling apps.
Less of a rabbit hole.
Exactly. Some people are even going back to basic flip phones or deleting apps to deliberately reduce that constant input, regain control over their attention.
Creating boundaries.
Yeah.
And the physical environment matters too, right?
Absolutely. Finding or creating distraction-free zones, like the law student who rented a hotel room on Saturdays just to get focused homework time, or using instrumental music, no lyrics, to pull your attention away.
Finding what works for your own brain. What about exercise?
Big one. There's anecdotal evidence, lots of it, suggesting daily aerobic exercise, running, swimming, whatever, can actually help tune a hunter's brain. Maybe similar effects to Ritalin for some people, providing that regulation and outlet.
Worth trying. And you mentioned Kemmons Wilson and his bear skinners. That points to another strategy.
Delegation and partnership. Hugely important. Hunters are often brilliant starters, ideas, projects, companies. But the day-to-day running, the routine stuff, that can be draining.
Farmer tasks.
Right. So know your strengths. Hire farmers. Partner with farmers. Delegate the tasks that don't play to your hunter strengths. The source says hunters start companies, but farmers often run them better long-term. It's about synergy.
Smart. Okay. And impulsivity. Any tips there?
A simple but powerful one borrowed from things like AA is just, wait, postpone big decisions for 24 hours if you can. Let that initial now, urge cool down.
The overnight test.
Yeah. And recognizing that cravings for excitement, sugar, whatever, don't have to be acted on immediately. You can resist them, redirect that energy.
Okay, these are great individual strategies. What about managing hunters in a workplace, if you're an employer?
Define goals clearly, but make them short-term and measurable. Not just boost sales, but make X calls today. Build in frequent feedback, daily evaluations if possible.
Keeps things immediate.
Exactly. And rewards should be short-term too. Long-term bonuses are often too abstract, too far away. Create systems, templates, checklists to guide the process, like a daily call log for a salesperson.
Makes sense. The structure helps contain the energy.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe accept that some roles, like sales, might just have higher turnover if they attract hunters. It's not always a failure.
It can be the nature of the role and the traits it attracts, yeah.
This feels really applicable to parenting and teaching Hunter kids too, creating systems.
Definitely. Larger than the child systems, the source calls them. Like a weekly chart with daily check-ins, give structure without constant nagging, and tap into their strengths, encourage special projects, things they can dive into for extra credit, feed that exploratory drive.
And labels. This seems critical.
Hugely critical. Call them hunters, explorers, lookouts. Something positive, not disordered deficit. Labels stick. Telling a child they have a disease or a problem can be so damaging. Frame their traits positively, enhance their self-esteem.
It reframes everything. And it critiques those traditional gifted programs too, right? The ones based just on grades.
Yeah, because those often reward farmer-style learning, sitting still, following instructions, memorizing facts. Hunters might bomb in that setting, but soar in hands-on, project-based, experience-based learning environments. We should group kids by how they learn, not just what grades they get in a system potentially biased against them.
It's about matching the environment to the individual, not forcing the individual into one standard environment.
That's the core message, really. Leverage the strengths, provide the right supports. Let their wiring be an asset.
Okay, let's talk treatments. Medication is obviously a big topic. There are real debates, concerns about long-term effects, dopamine receptors changing.
Yes, those are valid concerns and ongoing areas of research. And you hear powerful stories on both sides, like the man mentioned who was angry, felt he'd wasted his life before Ritalin, wondering what he could have achieved if treated earlier.
So it can be life-changing for some, maybe like training wheels, helping develop skills, or even life-saving in really tough situations like severe self-medication or in prisons.
It can be, absolutely. It's a tool, and for some, it's a vital tool. But it's not the only tool. What about alternatives?
All right. What else is out there?
Well, Dr. Feingold's diet had some impact on hyperactivity for some, though maybe not attention span directly. There are herbal remedies people explore, nutritional supplements like choline for memory.
Things people try. Any standouts?
One of the most interesting, especially for actually training the brain, is EEG neurofeedback.
Neurofeedback. Okay, how does that work? Is it real?
Oh, it's definitely real. Pioneered by people like Joe Camilla, Barry Sterman, Joel Lubar. It uses your own brainwaves, the EEG signals, to give you real-time feedback.
Feedback on your brain activity.
Exactly. The idea is to learn, through this feedback, how to produce more of the brainwave patterns associated with focus and calm, and less of those associated with distractibility or anxiety. And studies show it works like that example of eye surgeons improving their suture skills by 26% after neurofeedback training. It's about teaching the brain self-regulation.
Wow. And is this something accessible?
Increasingly, yes. There are devices now like the Muse headband. It's relatively affordable, connects via Bluetooth. You put it on, use an app, and it gives you auditory feedback, like hearing calm weather when you're focused and stormy weather when your mind wanders during meditation.
So it trains you to recognize and maintain that focused state.
That's the goal. Research is still ongoing at major places like Mayo Clinic and universities, but it's a really promising non-drug approach to brain training.
Very cool. Okay. Another huge factor for everyone, but maybe especially hunters. Sleep?
Absolutely huge. And there's this interesting theory about biphasic sleep from Dr. Thomas Ware's research.
Biphasic, meaning sleeping in two chunks.
Yeah, the idea is that waking up for an hour or two in the middle of the night might actually be the natural human pattern. Before artificial light, people slept, woke for a bit, then slept again. It might have been adaptive. Someone was always half awake in the tribe, keeping watch.
So waking at 3 a.m. isn't necessarily insomnia. It might be ancient programming.
Could be. And being a night owl, Dr. Matthew Walker and others argue that's often unavoidable DNA hardwiring. Not a choice, maybe another old adaptation. Think about Thomas Edison, a classic hunter type.
Famous for hardly sleeping.
Well, he slept maybe 4 or 5 hours at night, but took lots of short power naps during the day. That segmented sleep worked for him.
So maybe night shifts are a genuine solution for some hardwired night owls.
It could be a much better fit than fighting their biology.
And what about when you can't sleep, that racing mind, rumination?
Yeah, common struggle. Techniques can help. Talking yourself through things internally, dedicated worry time before bed, not in it. Or the Betty technique, focusing sequentially on senses. Mm. What you hear, then see, even in the dark, then feel, it can help quiet the chatter. And basic sleep hygiene, of course, regularity, cool, dark, quiet room, limit screens.
Good tips. This all leads nicely into celebrating some historical figures, right? The Edison trait, people who seemed like hunters.
Exactly. Thomas Edison himself flunked school, jumped between inventions, saw distraction as part of creativity. He literally said his inability to stick to one task was a strength.
Amazing. Who else?
Amelia Earhart. Tomboy, risk-taker, hyper-focused when flying, but impulsive. That story of her running out to deal with her dog chasing kids, there wasn't any time to be afraid. Pure hunter energy.
Definitely. Ben Franklin.
Yep. Flunked math, but was incredibly inventive. Stove, bifocals, lightning rod. Had that restless energy, political and personal impulsiveness. Always exploring new ideas.
Sir Richard Francis Burton.
Hmm.
The explorer.
Oh, yeah. A terror as a kid, failed at school. Mastered dozens of languages, explored forbidden places, fought duels. Needed isolation to write intensely, that burst focus pattern again.
Loving way.
Classic example. Restless, risk-taking, intense bursts of writing punctuated by, well, other intense activities like drinking or adventure. High highs, maybe low lows.
Thomas Carlyle.
The essayist. Struggled in conventional careers, then poured all that energy into his writing, which was known for being incredibly dynamic, full of energy.
And the ultimate fictional hunter.
It has to be Sherlock Holmes, right? My mind rebels at stagnation. Craving mental stimulation, solving complex problems, bored by routine, he embodies it.
It really shows how what might look like flaws in one context are the very engines of genius in another. It wasn't despite these traits they succeeded.
It was often because of them.
So zooming out even further, this hunter-farmer idea can apply to whole cultures, old versus young.
That's another layer the source explores. Old cultures, hunter-gatherer, some early agricultural ones tended to see themselves as part of nature, living in harmony with a living earth.
Whereas younger cultures, the ones that became dominant,
often saw themselves as separate from nature, having dominion over it. Earth as a resource to be used, exploited, which, the source argues, leads to the environmental issues we face now.
It's a profound difference in worldview. And it links back to ADHD, too. It's genetic, yes, but also shaped by culture and technology.
Right. It's nature and nurture. Marie Wynne's idea, the plug-in drug, suggested TV trains shorter attention spans. Now think about smartphones, social media, constant quick cuts, fleeting images. Our environment is potentially reshaping our brains, maybe making hunter-like attention patterns more common, or at least more noticeable.
But maybe. Maybe that's not entirely.
Yeah.
Is there a twist where the hunter brain is actually becoming more adapted to today's world?
That's the intriguing idea Ellen Lippman raises. In a world drowning in data, needing fast reactions, maybe that hunter ability to scan quickly, connect disparate ideas, make rapid decisions, maybe that's becoming an advantage again.
Future-proofed by ancient genes.
Could be. The very thing that causes friction in a rigid farmer-style structure might be exactly what's needed for navigating the chaos of the information age.
Okay, so wrapping this deep dive up, we've really explored how powerful it can be just to reframe ADHD. Moving from deficit or disorder to seeing it as a different perception.
Yeah, a set of inherited traits, skills, personality characteristics that had a vital purpose.
And understanding that difference.
Yeah.
It just changes everything, doesn't it? It lets people, individuals, parents, teachers, employers, empower and enable as the source is, not just label someone as sick or broken.
It's about finding and nurturing potential that might have been completely missed or even suppressed by the old way of looking at things.
So for you listening, now that you've journeyed through this hunter-farmer world with us, what does it spark for you? Any new thoughts about how you think, how you work, how you relate to others? Is there some unexploited potential in yourself? Or maybe someone you know that this lens helps you see? Something to cultivate